Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, in studio with Chase Palmieri. On today's program, has media literacy been hijacked? We'll discuss for the hour the issue of critical media literacy education in the wake of the last couple years of the growing interest and concern about fake news. We're joined by educators and scholars, Nolan Higdon and Ben Boynton. They're the authors of a recent article, Has Media Literacy Been Hijacked? That's at projectcensored.org. Please stay with us. Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, with co-host Chase Palmieri. On today's program, we are going to spend the hour talking about the significance of critical media literacy education, and we're going to be talking about the topic framed in a recent article published at projectcensored.org. Has media literacy been hijacked? Today's guests are no strangers to folks in the Project Censored audience. We have with us Dr. Nolan Higdon, who is co-author of this article, Has Media Literacy Been Hijacked? And of course, Nolan Higdon has a long history with Project Censored, longtime contributor to Censored Annual Yearbooks. He's a lecturer of media studies and history at California State University East Bay and University of San Francisco, as well as Diablo Valley College. He is co-author with me of a forthcoming book from City Lights called United States of Distraction, Media Manipulation in Post-Truth America. That'll be out this summer. Nolan Higdon sits on the boards of the Media Freedom Foundation, Action Coalition for Media Education, Northwest Alliance for Alternative Media and Education. That's in the Pacific Northwest. Nolan is also the co-founding member of the Global Critical Media Literacy Project and co-host of the Along the Line podcast. And you can find out more about that at projectcensored.org. Of course, Nolan, a former co-host here with Nick Baham and others of the Project Censored Show. Nolan Higdon, welcome to the Project Censored Show.
Mickey and Chase, thanks for having me.
You're more than welcome. And our next guest is someone that may be less familiar to our audience, but certainly no less familiar to us at Project Censored, and that would be Ben Boynton. Ben Boynton teaches media, English, film, and history at the high school and college levels, emphasizing student agency and empowerment. He is the vice president of the Action Coalition for Media Education. That's ACME. The website is smartmediaeducation.net. He is coordinator of the Global Critical Media Literacy Project, gcml.org, and he also sits on the board of the Media Freedom Foundation. His research is published in Media Education for a Digital Generation on Routledge. That's from 2016. Nolan Higdon, let's start with you. When the weaponized phrase fake news got off leash from the Democrats and the Washington Post and Donald Trump started using it after the 2016 election to basically criticize any journalists that were pointing out Trump's flaws, errors, foibles, outrageous behavior, racist, misogynistic comments, etc., he deflects it by calling them fake news. And over the period of the last couple of years, there's been a lot of attention about fake news, and suddenly misinformation, disinformation, and propaganda are on the minds of many. But at Project Censored, we've been charting those waters since 1976. Nolan Higdon, let's talk about this renewed interest in media literacy education.
Well, dating back 100 years ago, just with the introduction of film, people were interested in media literacy in the United States. And when you around the time you get like television and computers, you get a real big push by concerned citizens to start having media literacy courses. But about 30 or 40 years ago, most nations adopted some form of media literacy to their education, but not the United States. We really resisted the idea of media in the classroom. There was sort of this notion that media classes were, you know, for people who wanted to like watch television and entertain themselves, and they had no societal value. But once the outcome of the election demonstrated not only that people believed absolute falsehoods when they went into the voting booth, you know, this could be, we saw large portions of the population believe that Hillary Clinton was covering up a child molestation ring, for example. Some people believe that Trump had actually used his private jet to rescue people. These questions sort of emerge of like, where did these false narratives come from? Furthermore, you had people in the news media who were absolutely convinced that Hillary Clinton was going to win the election. They were reporting this almost like it was fact. Rachel Maddow at one point predicted it could be a Goldwater-like landslide, meaning she predicted this huge victory for Hillary Clinton. So you had these fake news narratives coming out. On top of that, you had Donald Trump attacking anybody who criticized him in the media as fake news. So there was this renewed sense and belief that false content presented at news was a problem for our democracy. And so it was a really kind of exciting time. Over 40 media literacy bills have been passed in about 26 states, where states are going to try and implement some form of media literacy, largely in response to what happened in the election. And, you know, as we've all done here on this radio program, for years we've been talking about the need for media literacy in general and news media specifically. It was a really exciting time initially because finally somebody was talking about the issues we've been talking about for so long. But as the article that Ben and I recently wrote, Ben Boynton and I recently wrote, The Hijacking of Media Literacy, some people had a different vision for what that media literacy was going to be. Ben and I were more concerned with what we call a critical media literacy that looks at the power dynamics behind false content and how false content is used to manipulate and exploit populations, where a lot of these so-called media literacy educators were more interested in getting these fun tools in the classroom and get students kind of used to using them and normalize them without really having conversations about the potential dangers or problems associated with these tools and content.
It seems like we're setting up a couple of different avenues here in terms of the media literacy jargon world. From the outside, a lot of folks probably don't differentiate between media literacy and critical media literacy. And of course, in Censored 2017, our 40th anniversary edition, media scholar Bill Usman wrote a fantastic chapter titled Who's Afraid of Critical Media Literacy? And that actually stemmed from experiences that he had at a media lit conference about that term critical. Nolan, help us understand the difference here between the two kinds of labels.
Critical scholars believe that everything we consume has some sort of bias behind it, that there's some sort of power dynamic or interest behind it. You can never find the so-called objective arguments. And as a result, they like to look at every single piece of media content that is constructed or disseminated to decide who made it, what's the message they're trying to send, what's their ultimate goal. And this comes from like a long school of thought dating back to World War II era. And so critical scholars believe we can't just sort of take these messages or tools at face value. They all have some purpose behind them that's connected to the people who are able to afford to create them and disseminate them. We get pushback from these media literacy scholars who claim we are biased in that. They think you can have objectivity and that we're being the ones who are biased in the classroom because we're asking people to critically think or criticize some of the media content they consume. And they consider that a bias and think we're doing an injustice as an educator by asking students to study these biases and power dynamics in media.
And at the Global Critical Media Literacy site, gcml.org, you and I and several others, Nolan, wrote about this media literacy project, the critical media literacy approach. And we actually offer a definition there that, again, is very similar to what you said, that it's a vital part, critical media literacy, of local to global education that provides tools through which to examine the political, cultural, historical, economic, and social ramifications of all media in a holistic way. And critical media literacy courses seek to teach students a critical awareness of power in media, the production of alternative media, and the relationship between media and audiences. And again, listeners that want to learn more about this can go online to gcml.org, and you can download our educator resource guide, over 100-page resource guide that we put together several years ago that obviously should be updated at some point. But there's a lot of groundwork there for people to understand the kind of concepts we're going into. And of course, Nolan, you said going back a ways into the 20th century, a lot of the core for this too is not unlike Paulo Freire, critical pedagogy. Critical pedagogy also concerns itself scholarly with issues of social justice and equality and so forth. So I don't think that we need to be, quote, objective about whether or not we need issues of equality or whether our media should have a moral economy to it. But it sounds to me like that's exactly why critical media literacy scholars get criticized from others.
Yeah, we sort of get misrepresented and painted into a corner that we teach courses where we try and indoctrinate students on what to think and what media to consume. But in reality, we just try and teach students to ask questions about the media they consume. There's no test at the end of class where you're mandated that you have to only consume one type of media over another. People are free to consume whatever they want. We just ask that they question the power dynamics behind them so they're aware so they can make an informed decision. Where a lot of media literacy scholars have sort of adopted the capitalist framework, and they see capitalism as objective. So when they're consuming media, they see it as a just kind of an objective exercise where we would argue that, no, you're actually consuming certain messages. There's capitalist messages behind commercial media. And it's okay to recognize those. To recognize them is not to say you have to reject them. As a critical scholar, we just want students to recognize that there's a for-profit model built into the media they consume. And if they still want to consume it, that's totally up to them, as long as they're aware of it. But again, media literacy scholars would criticize us that, and say we're being biased by somehow pointing that out to students.
So, Nolan, I'm curious, are you finding that in your classes, the younger generations have any kind of natural ability towards this critical media literacy, just simply because they've grown up with the internet? Have you noticed any difference?
Some of the scholarship bears out that older people are more susceptible to fake news narratives online. But as far as in the classroom, I find students are usually pretty interested in it. A lot of students, you know, will continue to consume commercial media, even though what goes on in the class, but they're always, you know, sort of thankful for the experience. And as an educator, I'm pretty, you know, inspired by young people that they're willing to find their own way when you give them these tools.
It's also interesting to note, Nolan Higdon, speaking to Chase Palmieri's point, the Stanford study from a couple years ago found that digital natives, young people that are growing up with technology, actually weren't any more likely to be able to discern or think critically about media that they were consuming. They were more adept at using technology, but they didn't necessarily show greater acumen in terms of critical thought. It was something that they also needed to develop, which is getting us back to the term critical media literacy. It's not just about learning how to use the gadgets and being adept at them and being able to produce certain media in hip new technological forms. It's also critically using it to criticize power structures, and also critically examining how technological companies or the technocracy or the technopoly, as Neil Postman would say, exerts its influence.
Yeah, and this gets back to an age-old debate between schooling and education. Some of these folks want schooling where basically individuals are pushed to memorize and regurgitate information, where education is about giving people the tools and perspectives to use their agency, use their autonomy to be able to kind of control their destiny. So if you educate someone, they'll be able to consume media and they'll be the ones who are in control and in power. Where if you give them schooling, you fill and drill. You fill them with a bunch of terms and actions that they then have to regurgitate on paper to pass the class.
Ben Boynton, let's bring you into the conversation. We've just been outlining some of the definitions here, trying to wrap our heads around this for the audience so they see the difference between what media literacy is or critical media literacy is and why there's a significant difference. But you're an educator and you're K-12 as well as college. What's your experience in the classroom with teaching critical media literacy?
One thing I'm thinking about right now is that idea that Chase brought up about this greater awareness or greater criticality of young people today. And I think you referenced that Stanford report, Mickey, and I read a piece recently, it was a report on a study, and I forget where it was from, but they made the really interesting point that what we have in our youth, so to speak, and they were talking, I believe, about college students, what we have now is a cynicism from our young people, a sort of rejection, oh, it's all garbage, which is actually more self-defeating than anything that we're trying to do with critical media literacy, because we're trying to bring questioning and skepticism, not outright rejection and cynicism.
That's a very important point, because all of us as educators, the last thing we're trying to impart upon students or the public is cynicism. People develop that pretty well on their own.
My interest is in agency. My interest is in how do we provide people with the tools and the knowledge to go out and make a difference, to go out and understand, to become critical consumers, sure, but to go well beyond that, because we now live in a world where we can take those tools of production and we can take action. We can understand what's happening and we can use the tools and almost turn them back on themselves. And I think one of the things that we run into when we talk about critical media literacy is there's a tension and there's a fear even out there in the world and in the world of teaching. And I can't speak as well to this at the college level, having less experience in that realm. But in high school and in even K-12, you know, I see it all the time where teachers are afraid to speak up. Teachers are afraid to take a political stand. We talk about how we're supposed to be objective and neutral in the classroom. And I hear this all the time. And I think we're well past that at this point. I think that's bunk. And that's not to say I'm interested in indoctrinating anyone, but it's to say I'm interested in open dialogue with students. And it's obviously harder the younger the student is, and you have to tread more carefully. But this idea that suddenly my saying my political stance on a particular issue out loud in a high school classroom is going to turn all those kids into crazy liberals is just silly.
It shows how little faith some in our population have in the youth, I suppose, that if they could be that easily indoctrinated, that's saying something else about our culture, which we'll come back to momentarily. I'd like to remind listeners that you're tuned to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, with Chase Palmieri. Right now, we are talking about critical media literacy and critical media literacy education. We're focusing here shortly on an article called Has Media Literacy Been Hijacked? It's an article recently published by our guests, Nolan Higdon and Ben Boynton. And after this musical break, we'll continue our conversation. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, with Chase Palmieri. With us today for our conversation about critical media literacy education are co-authors of a recent article up at projectcensored.org, Has Media Literacy Been Hijacked? Our guests, Dr. Nolan Higdon and Ben Boynton, both seasoned educators. Ben Boynton, we were talking to you before the break. One of the things that you said that really sticks, that I know that resonates with all of us as educators, whether that's in or out of the classroom, you know, education happens in many different forms, many different ways, not just in a classroom. But the idea of empowering people and encouraging agency is, I think, really what's behind critical media literacy, but in particular, critical thinking in general. It's about teaching people how to think critically, not telling them what to think. There are definitely key distinctions there. But Ben Boynton, you just mentioned some of the challenges that you face in a high school classroom. So give our listeners an example, if you could, about a particular issue or how something came up in class and how you dealt with it and what the ramifications were.
Every day is a new challenge. At the moment, I'm dealing with teaching an AP course, and we're spending some time interrogating the canon, so to speak. We're taking some time to look for connections to contemporary reality. We're taking some time to look at what was happening with people of color activism from those folks in time periods when most of us don't think of that as being current. And it's been really interesting to see some parallels to modern society. At the same time, there's a lot of backlash, even among the youth. And we tend to think, you know, a lot of us who have this sort of vision of the youth as being more welcoming and more embracing of different people's ethnicities and people's sexuality and sexual identity. And I think we have to be really careful with that. So I'm getting some pushback on occasion, and sometimes it's just the form of someone really wanting to say, well, why do we have to talk about race? And I say, well, because it's right there. How do you not talk about these? And so I find it really interesting. And then, and this isn't specifically media, but I had a conversation with a young man a few weeks ago who came in, and he, for whatever set of reasons, somewhat ironically, and he and I have talked about this, so if he happens to hear this, I don't think he'll be too upset, but he came in wearing a Trump 2020 hat into this high school in which I'm teaching. And he said he got called a racist, he got called a sexist, he got called all kinds of things that are not this kid's personality, right? Like, I know him well enough to say there's more going on here than what is on the hat. And I think that that's the problem we run into a lot of times with young people and in adult conversations too, where folks don't understand or don't want to understand beyond the sort of catchphrase. And so when we're talking about critical media literacy and issues in the classroom, I think that's a really important concept to look at, is how we frame the discussion, how we frame the argument, and how we present ourselves. So I had a conversation recently with that same group of students, and I'm pretty open, sort of philosophically, politically, in the classroom. And I don't preface the arguments that way or the discussions. I don't lay it out like, here's my position, believe this. They know me by now, and they probably can predict what I'm going to come down on if they were to bring up hot-button issue X, Y, and Z. Something that I consciously try to do is to say, in this room, we can talk about anything. and we can be honest with ourselves and each other, and we're going to listen and we're going to respect, even if we vociferously disagree. So it's really interesting to watch them try to navigate those waters because they're not used to that. We've conditioned not only our teachers but our students to be afraid of discussing politics in the classroom, even when there's an obvious and perhaps necessary connection to be made.
Ben Boynton, it just, again, harkens back to the writing from the Global Critical Media Literacy Educator Resource Guide, again, that our listeners can check out for free at gcml.org. I'm on page 10. This is what reminded me, going back to the definition of critical media literacy, specifically through institutional analysis, students are asked to analyze who gets to tell the stories of news and media, how non-commercial media diversify media narratives and perspectives, and how audiences have unique demographic qualities that enable them to interpret media messages differently. I mean, this is really content-rich material to apply both in and out of the classroom. And the article continues that the process begins by encouraging students to analyze the unprecedented amount of media content and digital technology that targets them, to recognize the ways that corporate media seek to colonize their time, money, and intellectual focus, and to track the difference in how commercial messages solicit them as consumers rather than citizens, and thus getting to the root of the ideological capitalistic motivations that drive the production of corporate media content. And now, Nolan Higdon, coming back to you, that's one of the key underlying statements that you made about differentiating the mainstreamed corporate-backed media literacy movement and organizations like the National Association for Media Literacy Education and partners with groups like NewsGuard that we'll talk about. But that's different than the critical media literacy approach. So what led you and Ben Boynton to write this really timely and important article? Has media literacy been hijacked? What do you mean there?
I think Ben illustrated this really well, that we have our own interpretations of the facts. And I think we put the word critical on our media literacy because we admit we take a critical perspective of media. We're going to delve into these sort of power dynamics. We're going to delve into the stories that are and are not told and the way we analyze media. The frustrating part is a lot of these media literacy educators, they get to say and pretend like they're objective. But as you guys pointed out in your conversation a few moments ago, they're not really objective. They're pushing ideas of the student being a consumer and these techno-utopian myths that technology is like the greatest thing ever and it'll save us. We just need to put technology in people's hands and get government off it. Those are fine perspectives for people to have, but to say they're objective is just unequivocally false. So what we started to notice when we were going to these conferences that increasingly this techno-utopian sort of pro-capitalist media literacy education was really dominating a lot of the discourses on media education. And especially when I looked at a lot of the bills that are being passed across the United States after the 2016 election to put media literacy in schools, Ben and I both noticed that a lot of it's media literacy. There's no critical component. And then sort of the final thing that kind of pushed us over the edge is we went to the annual International Critical Media Literacy Conference, which is one of the coolest conferences, a great place for educators and thoughtful citizens. And we noticed that NewsGuard was there, which is a private company that has ties to the intelligence and military and corporate media, that they were there at the International Critical Media Literacy Conference, basically trying to convince educators to use their content. At the same time, NAMLI, which works with Google, who also works with the defense intelligence industries, and NAMLI had also had Facebook as a speaker at one of their conferences, who also works with the military. And they were at the International Critical Media Literacy Conference as well. And that's not a knock on the International Critical Media Literacy Conference. I really do admire them for having a big tent and inviting any voice who wants to speak and come in. But I can't say that NAMLI and NewsGuard are doing the same thing. I mean, NewsGuard is actively trying to make a list. Usually it's smaller, more critical of the United States and capitalist websites. It tries to blackball. It tries to give them a red symbol next to their website to say they're not trustworthy. And NAMLI, they've really kind of privileged these scholars who will not criticize capitalism, not criticize the United States, not criticize big media at their conferences, and they've tried to marginalize critical media literacy scholars. So to see them there at the conference, it kind of brought up this question to Ben and I, and others at the conference as well. Is there some attempt now to hijack the little space we have as critical media literacy scholars? Are they trying to approach us on that?
NewsGuard in particular, you mentioned the Red Shield, Green Shield thing. Mint Press News, Manara Howish, has already run into issues with them where she was contacted by people from NewsGuard that basically were interrogating her rather than asking general questions to sort of blacklist Mint Press News. A lot of the people that are working with NewsGuard are people that come from the Wall Street Journal. They come from the corporate media. But of course, these are also people that don't call it corporate media. They think that what they do is so objective, they just call it mainstream.
You have Tom Ridge, the first Secretary of Homeland Security under George W. Bush. He's on the advisory board of NewsGuard. He sits there with Richard Stengel, who was the Undersecretary of State for Public Diplomacy under Obama. You have General Michael Hayden, a former director of the CIA and NSA under George W. Bush. He's on the board. And then you've got folks from like the Clinton communications team, NBC. It's a mixture of corporate media, intelligence community, political class, and military establishment who are now trying to determine for news consumers which news websites are a green emblem, which means you can read them and trust them. By the way, apparently Fox News is one of them. And then red, which you can't read, which are some of these really brave journalists. We forget because we see journalists on TV and corporate media, and they sit in a studio in New York and have this vapid discussion about tweets all day. But if you look at folks who are actual journalists going on the ground, like Abby Martin recently has returned from Venezuela, they go to these really dangerous territories that risk their lives to bring back information to us here in the United States.
And information that's unvarnished and doesn't go through the military-industrial surveillance complex filters that NewsGuard is basically putting up on the internet, on Microsoft Edge, Google Chrome. You guys write about this in your article. Ben Boynton, do you want to jump in here? What was your reaction seeing this stuff at the conference?
I saw Namely there, and I went, what? And thought that was kind of odd because 4 years ago, I think it was, we were in Boston at a media literacy summit, and this was sort of my, oh, this is what this is about moment, sort of an epiphany around not exactly the critical part, because I was working on that before that, on the schism, I guess, or on the distinct approaches. And I had a conversation, we were in a session, and someone very clearly well-intended, creative, clever, young teacher, entrepreneur, was building this tool for students to use. And it became clear that they were about to be bought, their app or their program was about to be bought by some large corporation. And we said, wait a minute, who's paying for this? Who's putting this in front of students? Is this really a good idea? And it became clear right away that there were three or four pretty, quote, important, unquote, media literacy educators who thought this was not only okay, but a very positive approach. And I was immediately troubled by that. And so I see Namely pop up at ICMLC in Georgia, and I go, what is going on here? What? Wait a minute. And it's not to say they're not allowed. I'm not going to say, hey, we can't ever talk to each other. But my first reaction was just the irony of it all. If they deny critical media literacy, why are they here? And while our title was dismissed as a clickbait headline, you got to use the tools you have, it's also a real question. And I want to have that discussion. And the reason we made it public is because it needs to be public.
Indeed, and so do we want to have it at Project Censored, which is why we were happy to publish the piece that you and Nolan did. I'd like to remind listeners, you are tuned to the Project Censored show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, with Chase Palmieri. After this brief musical break, we'll continue with our conversation around that poignant question, has media literacy been hijacked? Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, with Chase Palmieri. On today's program, we're talking about the importance of critical media literacy education. We are talking about some differences between the media literacy scene and critical media literacy, all under this big rubric in the last couple of years that has increased attention and awareness around the country about fake news and news and information control. And there have been some quick fix ideas about rating news, rating it or censoring it or blacklisting it or doing what NewsGuard does to try to veer people away from it. We've talked earlier about media literacy laws being passed. We might get back into some of that conversation, particularly in California, because I was briefly consulting with Bill Dodd in Sacramento about that before it became obvious that that bill got hijacked by corporate interests. And before the break, Ben and Nolan, you were both talking about your experience at the last International Critical Media Literacy Conference and some of the differences there. And Chase Palmieri, I think you had a couple things you wanted to bring to the table.
Yeah, I'm curious, at the conference, what the reception was from librarians and media literacy educators towards the NewsGuard idea. Specifically, I know that NewsGuard is trying to get their service into classrooms and to be built as a default in libraries across the country and all their major universities. So I'm wondering if those librarians and media literacy educators that you were surrounded with at that conference, did they seem eager to adopt this? Were they just as skeptical as you were?
This is actually the part that really scared me. A lot of folks weren't aware of who they are. NewsGuard came off looking like almost like a small independent educational organization. I don't think people were quite aware of the money and influence behind them at the conference. And I think this kind of echoes Ben's point he was making earlier, which is one of the big distinctions between critical media literacy scholars and media literacy scholars, is we as critical media literacy scholars, we study the power behind content and action. And we believe that if you take money from someone, that affects the content in which you disseminate. These media literacy scholars believe they can take money from companies like Google and Facebook, and it won't influence the content they create or the expectations for their classroom. Nikki and I have joked that this is like Upton Sinclair's quote, that it's difficult to get a man to understand something when his salary depends on his not understanding it. With NewsGuard, immediately I knew Steve Brill was behind it. I knew about some of the intelligence community interests behind it before I even got to the conference. That's why I was surprised that they were going to be there. They offered to set up meetings with people who were interested. And of course, I set up a meeting because I couldn't wait to see their market pitch. And as it turned out, most people, I guess, did not set up a meeting with them. And we had a big talking circle at the end of the conference where we got to share some of the research I had done, some other scholars like Emil Marmol and Ben Boynton. And the overall feeling was that we should really research some of these folks before they're at these conferences, just so we know who's there. As far as their marketing pitch, it was more or less a way of how can we get this stuff in the classroom. And I think Ben hit upon this earlier, which is, it sounds really great. I mean, it sounds like the easiest way to solve a fake news problem. We'll just put little green, red, or yellow emblems next to websites. And if it's green, you should go and consume it. If it's yellow, you should be cautious. And if you're red, you shouldn't read it. But the devil's in the details. There's some serious economic and ideological interest behind who gets a green, who gets yellow, and who gets a red. And we're not talking about true versus false. We're talking about sort of what fits into the conformist narrative versus which challenges the ideological hegemony of the power structures. So, Ben, I don't know, what was your take on people's reaction to NewsGuard?
First thing I want to say is that NewsGuard did not actually have a presence in the sense that they did not lead a session, they did not lead a workshop. They were just there, one person, one representative, and just talking to people. So it wasn't the sense of, it's a soft agenda, it's a soft sell kind of thing. They weren't there trying to blatantly, overtly sell their wares. And I think that a lot of people just didn't know. When we were in that ending session, reflective session with about 20 people from the conference who had been there the whole weekend, a whole bunch of people who were there, they didn't know what NewsGuard was. And so let us just say that Nolan and Emil Marmol wasted no time in letting them know what NewsGuard was. But I think it points to another issue that I wanted to bring up here, and it's this. A lot of what's going on with media literacy education is, in fact, because people don't know any better. And that sounds really more elitist than I wanted it to sound. I'm trying to be fair here. That we live in a place where we don't know what the problems are. And if we don't know what they are, it's akin to the quote you used, not exactly the same. I want to make a differentiation between what I kind of use these quotes around important media literacy educators or advocates and classroom teachers and professors. There's an important distinction there, and I want to make sure that when we're saying media literacy educators, that our listeners aren't thinking we mean all the teachers who are doing their level best to push in the best ways they know how. I want to be really careful with that because I think we run the risk of misidentifying and alienating people who otherwise might be wanting to do this work. There are media educators who are members of NAMLE who are doing critical work. And that sounds odd to some people, especially to those who already have a sense of criticality versus, shall we say, not criticality. But I know some of those folks. And one, I mean, Seth French, I think from University of Arkansas, was at the ICMLC in Savannah. He's an AMLI member, but he was doing a critical presentation, very specifically, clearly being critical. And the work was, to my estimation, really exciting. I know some teachers here in New Hampshire who are involved and are AMLI members, but I've been in this one teacher, I've been in her classroom, and there is definitely a critical edge. That said, I do think that there were people who, not knowing any better, said, oh, that looks great. And I had a conversation with my wife, who is a K-8 librarian, and my son, my older son, who's a 14-year-old high school freshman, about the work we were doing. And they said, well, what's the problem? I said, well, if nothing else, if we're just labeling things with red, yellow, and green, where's the critical thinking? Never mind the critical pedagogy. Never mind the critical media literacy. Where's the thinking? It's just quick fix. There's nothing there. There's no there there. And then when we dig at it, the there that is there is really bad, because it's tied up in all of these other status quo operations. That's the wrong angle.
So, Nolan, something you just mentioned was corporate investment, or investment from these media outlets, and how it affects the coverage or just the service itself of these, for example, in the case of NewsGuard, a media rating site. So we know that Google and Facebook just recently put together multi-hundred-million-dollar funds to invest in local journalism and other journalistic startups and projects, partly probably a little bit of guilt money in there for swallowing up so much of the classifieds market. But I'm wondering, Nolan, how you balance the idea that, well, if there is a solution and you want to get great talent and people working on it for a long period of time, or if you want the solution to scale worldwide to be able to service everyone, you are going to need to have a budget in place to be able to afford that. And just the idea that everybody's going to volunteer and it's going to work out isn't the solution. So how do you balance the fact that money is needed to solve some of these problems?
We're talking about journalism in capitalist economies. Of course, they're going to need money. Whether or not the journalist content is then scaled for global consumption, that's kind of another question. I think that needs to be a discussion both at the local, state, national, and global level. Do we actually want news content globally? And then, so I think that's a discussion worth having. Secondly, I think your point was dead on. Yeah, Facebook and Google are giving money to local journalism. We may be able to look at that as them investing in local journalism. I'm a little more cynical. I think that's them doing a PR campaign to make up for the missteps they've had, whether it be allowing sort of like white nationalism to flow or working with dictators around the world to censor information, et cetera. Nonetheless, though, if they put this money into local journalism, you may end up with a lot of local journalistic outlets that start reporting news. They get on their feet, they'll have journalists and editors and teams that are used to getting that money and used to reporting. But it may get to one day where that reporter wants to report on something that's not in the interest of where the money is coming from. And then those corporations have a decision of whether or not they want to take away the funding for those journalistic outlets. Or the journalists have the decision, maybe I just avoid this one issue and I'll be able to keep taking in money. Then maybe it's a second issue, maybe it's a third issue, maybe it's a fourth issue. And if you look back at what's happened historically to journalism in this country, that's been the case. Usually it's really wealthy donors who buy out media outlets and start these outlets out. And then over time, these outlets quickly get a larger and larger list of things they're not allowed to cover. I think one of the most recent examples of this is probably Jeff Bezos, heavily invested in Washington Post, as well as Amazon, as well as the food industry with Whole Foods. And now he's looking into other markets. His Washington Post newspaper is also, he's also heavily invested in the Democratic Party. They really limit their critiques of Democrats. Usually it's only to Democrats who lean further left into like socialism. So they'll criticize Bernie Sanders, but not Hillary Clinton. They probably won't have much criticisms of food justice to protect Whole Foods. So that's kind of, it's a cycle that happens slowly over time. It's not you get your first check and you immediately get your list of things not to cover. You sort of, as a journalist, figure out what's going to keep you employed and what's not.
Well, it's also the case, Nolan Higdon, in your article with Ben Boynton, you mentioned media scholar Zoe Druick, who wrote, media companies have aggressively sought out the classroom. So these kind of corporations are looking to get into education. They're looking to spread out on social media where people are more and more going for news content. And again, it's really important to peel back the curtain and look and see who are these people and what are their interests, which is what sparked your question when you saw these people at the International Critical Media Literacy Conference from NAMLI. And again, NAMLI is the acronym for National National Association for Media Literacy Education. And again, the Ford Foundation. The Ford Foundation was funneling money for the CIA programs at the same time that the CIA was dealing with the Washington Post in the 1960s and 1970s, where they had connections to the Washington Post and for propaganda and the mighty Wurlitzer that Brian Covert's written about for us. So, I mean, it's really important. You know, being critically media literate is what tips one off to asking these kinds of questions. And the flip side of Chase's question, another thing to put to that, is that there are actually major institutions that are sinking money into local journalism initiatives that are not the big tech companies. They're not techno-determinists. They're not part of the billionaire class. They might also be elite names. They may not be as squeaky clean as the grassroots citizen journalist movements we like to see. But from the Nieman Lab and Free Press, there have been numerous local journalism initiatives. Nieman Lab, in fact, announced last year that that was going to be one of their main focal points this year, reinvigorating local journalism. Media scholar Bob McChesney has written numerous books about how to get public funding involved. People in the United States don't realize that we don't really have a public media. NPR and PBS are flooded with corporate money. They just don't call it advertising. They call it underwriting. Most of their budget, in fact, comes from that. Ben, when you were talking, you were mentioning that even very well-intentioned or well-meaning people may just not be as well-informed or educated about what's been going on behind the scenes around information control in the United States and in the West, going back a century to Eddie Bernays, the nephew of Sigmund Freud, who wrote the book Propaganda in 1928. So that leads me to this question. One of the people that wrote critically of the article was Renee Hobbs, media literacy authority, one of the leading figures, in fact, that takes serious issue with the term critical. Could you, Nolan and Ben, maybe weigh in a bit on how someone is as significant in academia, and also she's like the bridge to the corporate money sector for the media lit crowd, not critical media lit, but the sort of media literacy industry. Can you talk about that?
Renee Hobbs has a long career in media literacy. She also has a long career of taking corporate money. Earlier, we talked about corporations being desperate to get media education in the classroom that teaches their tools. One of the first efforts of that was Channel One. This was decades ago. And she took Channel One money to create curriculum to get these corporate media in the classroom. Her justification is that, and this kind of goes back to what you guys were just talking about, that most people don't know what media literacy is. And so her ultimate goal is to get media literacy on people's radar. And if she has to take money from corporations and if she has to put corporate content in the classroom, she's willing to do all those things. And I'm not speaking for her. You can read her articles. She's mentioned this before. She believes, though, that if you criticize that point, that you're somehow attacking her and attacking the institution organization. I find the word attack to be really misleading. If you're an academic, an educator, or a civic citizen, you don't really attack people. You may criticize or debate or question, but attack to me is a really different thing. So the fact that she felt like she was attacked demonstrates, I think, some thin skin. Furthermore, I noticed that in her reply to us, she never actually denied that the corporate money impacted the work that she does. And I thought that was pretty astounding. You figure that if she found it so absurd that corporate money affects the impact, she would at least mention it. She never actually criticized or challenged any of the points that Ben and I made. She really just kind of made a false argument about us. She called us clickbait, never addressed our argument or issues. So I don't know. I don't know if it caught her off guard or what, but it seemed really inarticulate and didn't really help further this discussion. Because I do think there are people who do disagree with us who probably do have well-sound arguments that are worth listening to, but she clearly didn't make it in that article. I don't know what you would say, Ben.
She was very dismissive. And I think I would go even further than what you said. And I think she embraces those financial contributions or those relationships. And again, look, there is clearly an argument to be made. And as I said earlier, I think we want the argument to be public. We want the schism to be out loud and be dealt with, or at least be a threat of a conversation. I read her piece, and I think I don't know whether to categorize it as a response to us, because it almost felt like she was already writing a different piece, saw the article by whatever algorithmic means, and she's found the article, and then I think she just sort of put in that sort of small paragraph, very dismissive, referred to the critical plan or language to that effect, which again, it's not an intellectual debate. And I guess that speaks very clearly to what her position is on it, that she believes she's thought about it and finds it not worthy of discussion. And one is free to make that stance, but it's not respectful of the larger piece. Now, she would probably say, well, you weren't respectful of me. You guys attacked me. Well, okay, but couldn't we talk about
It's not an attack piece. This is a critical piece of what's going on, because in the last couple years, there's been a flood of money and attention now getting thrown at issues surrounding media literacy, critical media literacy. You know, I was one of the consultants for a brief period with Bill Dodd in California on the media literacy bill, and they had no idea about any of the stuff that we're talking about right now. But when I got in line with my late student TA, Tom Field, he was on this issue and is the person that got me into that office with dogged phone calls. And we found out about this only weeks into the game, and we were already at the back of the line. And Silicon Valley and the big tech companies and the corporate publishers were already ahead of us. So this is something that needs to be discussed and argued in public about who's making these decisions behind the scenes that are allegedly in the best interest of the public, that are actually about the bottom line and more insidiously about controlling public opinion and the parameters of legitimate discourse and debate, which is exactly what NewsGuard is trying to do. So the fact that any media literacy organization could somehow be tethered to an organization that has no interest in wide-ranging discourse and debate outside of a myopic capitalist center, it borders on fraud. It's an act of charlatanism, which is what makes me call it a Trojan horse. So there are many Trojan horses to fight fake news. We've got blacklists like PropNot, and now we've got NewsGuard. We've got legislative attempts. What we need is critical media literacy education, pure and simple. You both write this in the article. Just because you're working within that framework, and yes, you're using these tools, and yes, you're dealing with state curriculum that's influenced by corporations and the technology firms and so on, but that doesn't mean you need to stop being critical and stop deconstructing that from the inside while it's happening, so that the teachers can best and most expertly try to help students in the classroom be independent critical thinkers. Nolan, Ben?
Yeah, I think this discussion is helpful, and I want to just reiterate this point that if a media literacy person wants to criticize my perspective, or if I want to criticize a media literacy person's perspective, to me, that's okay. That's healthy for a democracy. But when we use the word attack, I think that's way more personal. And just to make it clear, I don't know Renee Hobbs personally, and I don't have anything negative to say about her personally. This is merely about her position or her publications. To your point about the classroom and why we want to make this a public debate, this debate's been going on for decades about funding and education. But it's largely been in these academic journals that no one reads but academics. And our concern is that you have millions of parents who are sending their kids to school, and then you have millions of college students who are going into classrooms, and they're being taught, quote unquote, media literacy. And they don't realize that this stuff is actually designed by people who do not have their best interests at heart. They have a real economic motive for the content in the classroom. I mean, that's why we mentioned in the article, it's kind of laughable that NAMLE says their goal is to empower young people. Well, how are you going to empower young people when you're collaborating with Google while Google's taking their data and using that data to brain hack and exploit these young people, you keep them addicted to their screens and things like that. So I think it's really important for parents especially, but all students, to kind of make a decision about the content they're about to consume in the classroom, because most people in this country won't get a media literacy education at all. And if the only media literacy we have is designed by these corporations and their for-profit model, I think there's some serious threats to democracy.
Ben Boynton?
Yeah, I mean, if you're not opening that door to actual questioning of the power structures that live behind the images, behind the messages, behind the stories that we love, then we're not doing it right. I mean, I very blatantly have started explicitly in media work and in almost all of my teaching is sort of seeking explicitly at the beginning of a discussion, what's your emotional reaction? What did you like? What did you not like? I think you have to bring that to light. For me, critical media literacy is it's reading, it's writing, it's research, it's psychology, it's sociology, it's economics, it's politics. It's all of this stuff tied together. And we can use it to really delve into cross-disciplinary work, interdisciplinary work that really leads students on a path of agency instead of on a path of regurgitation.
Go ahead, Nolan.
Some great resources that complement what Ben is saying there. At projectcensored.org/ATL, we have a Along the Line podcast with Allison Butler where she kind of lists these ways you can be a more responsible media consumer, some quick ways. And then, of course, Ben is the Global Critical Media Literacy Project. So at gcml.org, educators can find a lot of content to enhance their classroom as well.
I was just going to say that obviously critical media literacy predates the internet, but what I'm personally fascinated with is how critical media literacy has been affected or is living in this new world with the internet. And there's two things that I really want to hear your thoughts on. The first is that with the internet, now anybody can write something and hit publish. And so in a sense, critical media literacy becomes more important than ever when anybody can hit publish on seemingly well-branded looking information. And then the second piece, and this is where I'm more hopeful, is that for the very first time, news consumers can actually be connected and working together. So for example, it used to be people would read the newspaper and you would maybe be able to talk about the day's issues with the people that were around you while you're reading that newspaper. But for the first time, news consumers can actually connect and possibly work together in totally new ways. So I'm curious how you think media literacy or critical media literacy is different now that the internet has arrived.
One component of critical media literacy that some of the founders of the field talk about is that part of teaching people about media and the power dynamics in media is having them create media. So there's a lot of new tools out there that give students the opportunity to create media. I mean, they've been around forever, but there's a lot more of them available, and students really seem to engage. And if you question as they go through the process the decisions they are making, you can then ask them, well, if you were a corporation, how would you address this decision? Or if you were a parent, how would you address this decision? And so we kind of teach them about the power dynamics. And most of the studies are pretty clear that if you teach students to be more responsible media producers, they become more responsible media consumers. As far as the second question, the connection, I think, is both a good and a bad for society. It's obviously a good because people can connect. Ideas that normally didn't penetrate to the surface can now be connected across the globe. You can get people to jump onto different movements or perspectives, basically from their living room. However, the downside of that is some of those movements and perspectives can be quite negative and quite hateful. I mean, we've been talking a lot about fake news today. You know, the majority of themes in fake news are pretty hateful. We know it would be racist, sexist, homophobic, et cetera. Now folks can kind of find each other. And thanks to algorithms and the quote-unquote free choice of the internet, which is actually, again, data-driven algorithms, people can get reinforced in those hateful views. And the more and more you get this sort of hateful content, the more kind of paranoid and fearful people can become until they act in some sort of radicalized manner, like Caesar Sayoc, for example, mailing bombs to people at CNN and the Democratic Party, or some of these meninists online who are going after women who they think are guilty of committing a crime against them because they won't have sex with them.
Incels, yeah.
So there's some negative side of that as well. And one other negative I'll throw out there that I like to always make people cautious of is that you now get to choose the news you want to consume, but sometimes the news you want to consume may not be the news you need to consume. There's some pretty boring, like wonky articles out there, but they deal with critical issues of like economics or water safety or climate change. Those are really deep articles to explore. They're not as deep to explore as like Jesse Smollett faking a hate crime, which is a lot more sensationalistic and kind of easier to wrap your head around. But what happened to Smollett probably is going to have less effect on your life than poisonous water or having a lack of air to breathe. So just because you can choose what you want and these algorithms reinforce the what you want, we may be missing out on what we need to consume as members of a democracy.
Ben Boynton.
I would say to Chase that the water cooler is now potentially millions of people instead of the four friends of yours at work. And that's good and bad for kind of all the reasons that Nolan laid out there. I would also say that production has to be a component of media literacy, critical media literacy courses. The reasons are many. One of them is you don't really know how media works until you make it. When I was teaching a film class, when I was teaching this media course I taught in a high school for 9 years, production was a necessary component. And these were tools in a very small school that got pretty good budgets for tech. But I think that it can be done now. Now, a majority, I won't say it's as many as most of us think it is, but a majority of our students have essentially a television studio in their pocket. So if we're not using that tool in our media literacy work, then we're not really accessing the full range and the full set of skills that we need to have. That's the action part. And I will say that the production is necessary, and that's a push that I'm trying to bring into any work I do now, whether it's conferences, whether it's courses on teaching, whether it's college, whether it's high school, that we have to start looking at how do we bring production in a very conscious, deliberate, and continuous way. And then the last thing I would say about media education, media literacy, critical media literacy education, is we have to get working with teachers, and we have to work with them on kind of a grassroots level, not presenting another top-down magic bullet solution, but working with teachers to say, what are the needs needs of your students in your community, in your classroom, and how is that applicable and transferable to other people, which is kind of the work of the Global Critical Media Literacy Project.
And listening to our students in the classroom and critically listening to the things that they tell us and how they experience things so that we can better tailor and address some of this really key and critical information in a way that they can not only digest it, but so that they can make it their own and go out into the world and use it to strengthen, as Dr. Nolan Higdon was saying, to strengthen our democracy. And judging by the things that have been happening here in the last several years, we've certainly been in a civil crisis, to say the least. But on that note, I think critical media literacy education is really an antidote to this, and it's really helpful. And it really helps people understand it and communicate better. And hopefully we'll see more people doing more of that. And as usual, the Project Censored Show is it airs around the country, but we have the programs archived at projectcensored.org. And each episode, we list people that are on and give a lot of links. So I'm just giving our listeners a heads up. I know that we ran through a lot of terms and people and organizations, and maybe some of those things are less familiar to some in the audience. So we'll make sure we make a link with all of those places and things, and Allison Butler, Dr. Susan Merritt, whom we didn't mention, who has a great resource guide, a process for establishing information integrity checklist on the GCML site. Again, so many great resources. And ACME, both Nolan Higdon and Ben Boynton, our guests today, are on the board over at the Action Coalition for Media Education, smartmediaeducation.net. They're also on the board of the Media Freedom Foundation that oversees us here at Project Censored. For the hour, we were talking about a recent article they just wrote, Has Media Literacy Been Hijacked? That's from March 19. You can read more about that at projectcensored.org. Nolan Higdon, Ben Boynton, thank you both gentlemen for joining us on the Project Censored Show today to talk about this very interesting and timely subject.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign.
You've been listening to the Project Censored Show, established in 2010 by Mickey Huff and Peter Phillips. Mickey Huff is executive producer and host of the program, with myself, Chase Palmieri. Anthony Fest is our senior producer, and Dennis Murphy is our associate producer. The Project Censored Show airs on over 40 stations around the United States, from Maui to New York. To learn more about our work or to find any of our previous archived programs, please go to projectcensored.org and follow and like us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and be sure to subscribe to the official Project Censored Show on your cell phone's podcast app. Last but not least, thanks to you, our listeners, for tuning in. We'll see you next time.
Visualize alibis, disguise, another guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burn bright with waves full of poison. Genocide wars fall for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks upon the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons build the capacity, citizens. And the times for the master thief, combine and conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential fame at the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got that love.